Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 288. How do you quickly get an understanding of what's inside a new set of data? And how can you share an exploratory data analysis with your team? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss a recent Real Python tutorial about why data profiling. This library lets you quickly generate an exploratory data analysis report with a few lines of code. The report provides column-level analysis, visualizations, and summary statistics that can be exported to HTML to share with others. We cover an article by Trey Hunter about building your own Python comprehensions. Python includes list, dictionary, and set comprehensions. But what if you want to create ones for other collections, such as a tuple, frozen set, or a counter? We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a collection of recent releases and PEPs, using the Django ORM as a standalone module, a history of attempts to eliminate programmers, a discussion of bad managers, a modern Python project template, and a CLI to summarize code size by language. Today's episode is sponsored by Agent Field. If you've hit the ceiling on prompt chains, Agent Field is what comes next. Open source infrastructure for building multi-agent systems in Python. Clone, deploy, or adapt three production-ready examples today. An autonomous engineering team, a deep security auditor, or an adversarial code reviewer on any model. Clone one today at agentfield.ai. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right. Well, we have a set of standard fare for everyone here. We got some news with releases and PEPs, a handful of topics. We do have a discussion this week, which I think will be interesting to dig into, and some projects. So you all set to dig in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Been a couple of weeks since our last PyCoders episode, so it shouldn't be surprising that we have some release news and a couple of PEPs. First off, a Python security release for a couple of the older versions, 3.12.13, 3.11.15, and 3.10.20. As an aside, the PSF has changed the tool that they're using for their blog, and the new release announcement page is pretty. It used to make you dig a bit to find exactly what was in the release, but this now has it all laid out for you. Along with that, 3.15 Alpha 7 is ready for you to explore as well.
Wow.
Yeah. Progress.
Yeah.
The second bit of release news is for Django 6.0.3, 5.2.12, and 4.2.29. This patches a potential denial of service vulnerability on Windows and a default file permissions problem. We've also got two PEPs. The first is 8.25, which is titled Wheel Variants Package Format. This proposes an expansion to how a Python package specifies what installables are inside of the package, which opens up the possibility for variations on binaries. If implemented, this will mean your installation tool could make some choices like, hey, whether you've got a compiled GPU add-on or something like that, and the package can include those options.
Yeah, I noticed a special contributor in there, Charlie Marsh from Astral.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff that the changes in UV are pushing some thinking about how we do stuff. So, and the other PEP is 8.27, which is titled Type Manipulation. Python is a bit of a mishmash of language features. Typing in particular was added late in the game, and in comparison to other languages, it's a little rough. So there's some limits on what typing can do. Although it is a gradual typing system, at the moment it's really limited to just static typing, even though the language itself supports all sorts of metaprogramming mechanisms. For example, you can't currently use typing on something like the Django ORM due to the dynamic nature of that structure. This PEP is heavily inspired by TypeScript, and it proposes a general mechanism to address exactly this problem. I've already seen a couple of blog posts from key Django people who seem to be excited about the potential for this one.
Cool. All right, so it's time to dig into some topics here. My first one is a Real Python tutorial from Isabel Zimmerman, who's a new author at Real Python. So glad to see your work appear on the site there, Isabel. It's titled Automate Python Data Analysis with Y Data Profiling. We've talked about this type of tool in the past on the show. You have a data set and you kind of want to wrap your head around it quickly. Or maybe you need to quickly show someone else what's happening with that data set. And this sort of category of tool is considered an EDA or exploratory data analysis. And in this case, it's like a report. If you haven't tried a tool like this and are interested in data science, I think this is going to be a nice quick tutorial to get you in to play around in EDA, if you will, and get some results. Another thing that's really nice is it's, especially for those kind of coming to Python from like the data science world, it doesn't require a whole bunch of code. It's really quick and easy to use this library. It outputs interactive reports with summary statistics that you might be used to by doing like a describe or something else on a data frame. It also then would include visualizations that kind of depend on the data type. You can do correlation matrices and data quality warnings, all coming out of whatever data frame that you're giving it. And then you can save it as HTML. That's one of those things that I think is really great as far as like being able to share this report with somebody else and have them be able to kind of play around in the data and figure out what's happening. Or you can save it as JSON if you'd like. Or you can output it in line into like a Jupyter notebook like cell if you'd like. A couple other quick features that she mentions at the top. It can do time series analysis, and it has a comparison method for generating these sort of side-by-side reports. One major note is that it's really based around pandas. That'll come up more as I go through this here. I think they probably would be looking at ways that it could work with other libraries, but by default, it's set up for pandas. So Isabel takes you through installing the package using pip. Once you're set, the tutorial includes a link to download some sample code and the data set that's being used across that sample code as a CSV file. It's about 2024 flight delays. Wow, you could have a lot more from the following year. even now, maybe, I don't know. But you start by generating a profile report. It takes like 5 lines of code. 2 of them are imports and 1 is creating the data frame from pandas. So, you know, literally it's like 2 lines for doing this function called profile report. And then you take that profile that you've created and you add the toFile method to it, .toFile. And then you can build and save that as HTML or JSON or the other things that I mentioned before. And now you have this interactive visualization with statistical summaries and data quality warnings that you can comb through or share again with your team. It's interesting, in the middle of this, it has a comparison chart to say, is this maybe not what you were looking for in a way, which I found kind of interesting. It then is describing other use cases. If you're doing data exploration and you're working with sort of this medium-sized data set, this data set is 10,000 rows, which I would say is kind of medium. It's a good tool for that. But if you're looking with really large data set, you may want a tool that is able to do more just sort of quick summaries. And that way you might use Pandas' built-in describe method. Or there's another one that she mentions that's called, I'm guessing it's spelled Skimpy, but I'm thinking it's SkimPy. And if you want to dig much deeper into data quality issues more specifically, we've mentioned a tool called Pandera a few times, and that's for like validating schemas and looking for errors in your data or your data pipelines. So the tutorial takes you through several examples of going a little further with Y data profiling. She shows you some column level analysis examples. A text column would be able to show you standard information. There's missing values and things like that. And then it pops out a visualization on the side as a word cloud. In this case, it's destinations. So these are airport 3-letter codes. So DEN for Denver, which I'm very familiar with. You might be familiar with LAX or HNL, if you've been to Honolulu.
YYZ forever.
Yeah, I know. I was going to come. So not just a Rush song, if you ever wondered where that came from. And then if you're doing numerical columns, she has this one that's in this data set of departure delays, which is kind of what the data set was about. You would then have like a display of minimum values, maximum values, if there's zero values, things that are missing. And then in that case, it shows a visualization to the side to give you information on what's happening. You can add metadata to this, so your report has a little more human readable information inside of it. If you're, again, maybe you're sharing it with someone else, it has a dictionary inside of a variable argument descriptions, literally, and you can then add more information for each column to kind of explain what's happening or what data somebody would be looking at. The tutorial takes you into, as I was mentioning before, this idea of specifying time-dependent columns and generating additional time series analysis, and then how to create comparison reports to look at data drift or identify pre-processing errors. And you can use it to preview train test type splits that you might want to be able to know, like, okay, well, how representative is this data that I'm using as training or using as testing, and confirm their distributions. The package was originally called Pandas Profiling, hence the sort of dependency on pandas there, but it changed a couple years ago to Y-Data Profiling. I think they should meet up with Marco Gorelli and get this thing on working with Polars or some of these other libraries that are out there. So again, it's a quick tour, but if you're looking for a way to get into exploratory data analysis, I think it's a good place to start. So thanks, Isabel. All right. So what do you got for your first one here, Chris?
I've got an article by Paolo Melchiorre, who we featured way back in episode 227. That article was about Django databases, and so is this one. This article is titled Django ORM Standalone Querying an Existing Database. In case you're not familiar with Django, it's a web framework that includes an ORM mechanism. ORMs are a way of mapping tables in a database to objects in Python. So if you're trying to store a person with a first and last name, you'd create a Django model called person with those fields, and then the framework translates that into a person table with columns that correspond to those fields. The typical use of Django is to create a web project, and people like the ORM enough, there have been calls over the years to extract it from Django as a standalone tool, but the project maintainers have mostly declined. That said, there are some things you can do that kind of fake that out, and that's kind of what Paolo's article is about. Say you've got an existing database and you want to use Django's tools to muck around inside of it. Normally, this isn't what you do. Normally, you start with the objects and then it creates the database from there, but that doesn't mean you have to do it that way. Since Django is a web framework and the ORM isn't an independent library, the first thing you have to do is a little strange. You have to create a project as if you were going to build a new website, even though you might not be. It can be the bare minimum, and really all you're doing is getting the configuration in place so that you can attach your minimal project to the existing database. Every Django project contains a settings.py file that defines a set of variables that describes how the project behaves. One of these variables is a dictionary called databases, intuitively enough, and it specifies one or more database connections that your project uses. Under the hood, Django passes these structures to a configuration method, which is what gets everything going. What Paolo shows you how to do is write a single script file that mimics a Django project, including calling that same configuration method, passing in a dictionary, which then sets up your database connection. Depending on what database you're connecting to, the values you specify in the dictionary are different. For example, to connect to an SQLite database, the key engine gets the value SQLite, and the key name gets the database file name. If instead you were connecting to Postgres, you'd use a different value for engine and other key value pairs to connect over the network. Django comes with a series of command line tools you can use on your project, one of which connects to the database. You can use the db shell command to test if all this configuration you just did works. And then once you've got that going, now for the backwards part. Since you're starting with an existing database, you need some way of creating Django model classes. One of the built-in command line tools is inspectdb. When you run this command, you give it the name of a table, and it outputs a corresponding Django class on the screen. You, of course, can then capture that to a file. Inside this generated class is a meta property, managed, which is set to false. This value tells Django it isn't managing the corresponding table, which means it won't try to create or edit that table. And since you're attaching to an existing database, that's exactly what you want. Once you've got all that set up, you can now use that model it generated like any other in Django and query the data in the table. You can invoke Django's REPL, you can interact with it there, or you could write Django management commands or do script-like things. Although this is a little weird and backwards, it can be handy for people who are more comfortable in the Django world than in raw SQL, and this technique is also handy for integration. If you've got an existing Django web project that also needs to attach to another database and share some information with it, this approach allows you to do that within the realm of your code. So, another tool for your Django tool belt.
It reminds me of one of the demonstrations. I'm going to forget the person's name. I'll try to add it maybe in the show notes. But when we went to Ireland last year, there was a workshop showing how to use Marimo, the Marimo notebooks with Django. And this person was building kind of this kind of simplified connector to it. So you're doing sort of Django REPL kind of stuff and being able to, like, you know, look at data and play with it. And, you know, again, kind of going back to my last thing I was talking about of data exploration. But this sounds kind of, in a way, somewhat similar to this idea that you have this way of just attaching a database and then working with the ORM.
Yeah, I know some of it is just because I use it more, but I find the Django ORM far more intuitive than the SQL Alchemy one.
Yeah.
So I have done things like this, like for one-off pieces where I need an ORM, I don't want to bother using SQL Alchemy, and so I've Django-ified something.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily do it for public consumption because that's a little confusing, but if I need to do something quick and dirty with some database tables, yeah, I've got a couple non-Django projects kicking around in my projects folder for exactly this reason. So
that's cool. This episode is brought to you by Agent Field, open source infrastructure for building agent harnesses in Python. Here's the shift Agent Field is built around. Once your agents are reading files, running tests, and backtracing on failure, they have their own internal process, and prompt chains were never designed for that. Agent Field lets agents run as real API services, discover each other at runtime, coordinate autonomously. No DAGs, no glue code. SDKs in Python, TypeScript, and Go. They ship 3 production examples you can clone, deploy, or adapt today, an autonomous engineering team, a deep security auditor, and an adversarial code reviewer. Search Agent Field on GitHub or visit agentfield.ai. My next one is another tutorial by Trey Hunter. I've featured him a bunch recently. This is from his Python Morsels site. And if you're moving from like being a beginner Python coder toward intermediate, you probably have started to look at ways to make your code more succinct, or you might have heard the term Pythonic. And there is this thing that a lot of people have showed maybe in tutorials and you've kind of wondered about it, and it's called a comprehension. And there's a variety of comprehensions. The most common one is a list comprehension, but you can also make a dictionary comprehension or a set comprehension. I'll include a link to some real Python tutorials and video course that sort of dig into that topic. But for a short explanation, I'll take it from the real Python glossary here for a list comprehension. It's the most common form of comprehension in Python and allows you to create lists in a concise way. You can kind of think of it as a for loop in some ways, sort of stood on its head. In a set of square brackets, you have an expression and then for item in an iterable. You can also have a conditional statement at the tail of that if you'd like, but this doesn't really go far into that. You know, here's like an example. Let's say you have an iterable that's just a list of numbers and you want to quickly turn that into a list of squares. So in that case, it would be square brackets, x with the raised to the second power, the asterisk 2, for x in numbers. And then when you feed that into that, it would output a new list that has all those numbers squared. So this is kind of a quick way to create these lists or potentially dictionaries or other things. And it kind of looks a little more elegant as one line of code. There's this balancing act of like, is it more readable? Is it less readable? Well, again, if you have comprehensions inside of comprehensions, maybe not. But a lot of people really, really like them. And Trey was wondering, well, what if I wanted it for some other type of container. And so he thought about, well, what would the syntax be for creating a tuple or a frozen set or maybe using something like a counter? And that's where the title of the piece comes from, Invent Your Own Comprehensions in Python. And Trey shows you can use very similar syntax by using a generator expression. And a generator expression takes the example I gave you a minute ago, where you'd have square brackets and you put it in parentheses. What it outputs is not then like a list or a finished object. It outputs a generator iterator. And I'm not going to dive into generators here, but again, quick Real Python glossary, a generator is a function that returns a generator iterator. The returned object allows you to iterate over the data without the need to store the entire data set. You won't see it displayed. It won't be there in memory all at once. Instead, generator iterators yield items one at a time and only when requested, making them more memory efficient. So there's a lot of reasons why you might want to use a generator. This is maybe not one of them. It's kind of an interesting thing because you're going to immediately feed this into something else. So in this case, he has you feeding the generator iterator that's created by the generator expression into an iterable accepting function or class. So if you remember the list comprehension, again, squaring numbers, think of it in parentheses, you know, or round brackets. Is that how other people in the world would say it compared to square brackets? At the front of it, though, you'd use the tuple constructor. So tuple parentheses n star star 2 for n in numbers, closing your parentheses. And then that would actually output a tuple that has all those values squared from numbers. So he continues to show how you could use this technique to create like a frozen set comprehension, a counter comprehension. A counter is a really nice built-in in the standard library you can use to add account to different things or count the values of things. And then he also shows how the generator expression pairs well with like reducer functions. Like if you wanted to use it with sum or math.prod or the other sort of Boolean tools of like any and all. And that way you can take an iterable and reduce it down into the singular value. So it's a fun explanation on how you can invent your own comprehensions. Technically, they're again, passing a generator into a function. But it's another way, if you want to explore some of these more advanced things inside of Python, and maybe you like the elegance of the way the comprehensions sort of look, and it shows that you can really build a lot of your own solutions inside of Python. It's a very flexible language. So thanks, Trey. All right, what do you got up next?
I haven't been using AI tools enough to have a strong opinion on whether they're going to change the world. I have my suspicions, but that's for a different podcast. Lots of blogs, though, have been giving me deja vu, especially those that talk about the end of programmers as we know it. And then I came across Ivan Turkovic's article titled "The Eternal Promise, A History of Attempts to Eliminate Programmers." And I couldn't help but share it, even though it isn't quite Python specific. So gather round, young ones, as this old man tells a tale that seems to be as old as programming time, how some new tech will mean the business will no longer need us programming types. The article starts out with COBOL, which was a programming language invented in 1959, and its name is an acronym. COBOL stands for Common Business Oriented Language. The hint was right there in the name. Give the business people a way of coding for themselves. COBOL is very English-like, and the theory was anyone who speaks English could code. The syntax was kind of verbose. It contained keywords like move, add, and multiply, and not quite the poetics of Shakespeare, but readable as English. And since it's over 60 years later and programmers still have jobs, I don't think it's a spoiler to say this didn't work out as planned. COBOL was and is a very successful language. There are still millions of lines of it running today. It's the backbone of banking, insurance, and government systems worldwide.
Yes.
And although it didn't succeed at letting the business folks get rid of us, it did provide a lot of work for programmers. And as it isn't a common skill anymore, it's highly sought after. It actually pays quite well to maintain those critical legacy systems that still run pretty much everything. So let's move forward in time a little to 1965. Herbert Simon, a founding researcher of AI, predicted that within 20 years, machines would be capable of doing anything a person could do. Yep, do the math. That's 1985, which is significantly in the past. Similarly, in 1967, Marvin Minsky, another AI pioneer, predicted that within a generation, AGI would be substantially solved. Huge amounts of money were spent on trying to progress towards this goal, but by the mid-1970s, reality had intervened. The money dried up as people realized we were nowhere close, and the first AI winter was upon us. You may have come across the phrase expert system. Want to know the difference between an expert system and AI? Marketing. When the first AI winter came about, nobody doing AI research could get funding, so a little rebranding happened, and all of a sudden, we were doing research in expert systems instead. It seems like this happens almost every decade. In the 1980s, it was fourth-generation languages, also known as 4GLs. Assembly was first-gen, Fortran and COBOL second, C and its brethren were third, and this new set were the fourth. They were going to change everything. Now, not to say that 4GLs didn't help things. In fact, you could argue that things like Microsoft's Power Builder is built on top of the ideas in Access, which at its heart was a 4GL. But somehow, DBAs still seem to be employed, and names like Focus and Nomad have been relegated to the dustbin. In the 90s, it was CASE tools. CASE stands for Computer Aided Software Engineering, and these were some of the first drag-and-drop coding interfaces. A lot of them were flowchart-based. You drew pretty diagrams, and the computer generated the corresponding code. I remember using these in university and thinking, why would I do this when I could just write C? And evidently, I wasn't alone in that thought. The resulting code from CASE tools tended to be bloated and inefficient. Diagrams are limited by screen size, so you end up with a lot of go-to-like hopping around for larger algorithms and results in harder-to-maintain diagrams. The generated code wasn't meant to be maintained directly, so you couldn't even use it really as a starting point. Like with 4GLs, some good did come out of this. Object-oriented coding uses some of the same data modeling ideas that were in CASE tools, but CASE tools themselves have gone the way of the dodo. Another one down. As you might guess by the fact that I've only reached the 90s, the article has a lot of content in it. It goes on to talk about yet another AI winter, how a lot of this was reinvented with the web with tools like Dreamweaver, how at one point UML was going to save us all, and then the resurgence of low and no coding tooling. Ivan finishes the history lesson by talking a bit about LLMs. He admits that this time could be different, but like with the other times, it won't be for a few years before we see how much the tech survives and how much is yet another faux silver bullet. To close off, the article talks about the patterns and why the promise of replacing developers has always fallen short. Precise specification of behavior is difficult. Even if the language you're using to specify what needs to be done is English, you have to be able to express exactly what you want. A few years back, I was teaching a class on the concepts of DevOps for a mix of both programmers and non-programmers. Since DevOps is all about things like CI/CD, doing exercises without code was a bit of a challenge. So my buddy and I came up with an idea. We had them write down the instructions for a person to walk from one part of the room to the other, pick up a ball, and bring it back. I then acted like a robot and followed exactly their instructions. If they didn't tell me how to turn at the right time, I would follow their instructions and bump into things and never get there. What astounded me was less than half the class could do this to any reasonable degree of success. The skill of breaking things down into steps is harder than it appears. Embarrassingly, even some of the coders in the room weren't terribly good at it. So if you define a programmer as someone who precisely expressed behavior to achieve a business goal, well, then our tools might change, but I can't imagine the job's going to go away. So, great article by Ivan, lots of good stories in here, and I can actually remember experiencing at least two examples that weren't included, so there's that.
All right. It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course, and it's titled Understanding Python List Comprehensions. The course is based on a RealPython article by James Timmons. And in the video course, Rich Bibby takes you through how to rewrite loops and map calls as a list comprehension in Python, supercharging your comprehensions with conditional logic, how to choose between comprehensions, loops, and map calls, and using comprehensions to replace a filter. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to learn one of Python's most distinctive features and how you can use them to create powerful functionality within a single line of code. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Well, that takes us into a discussion, and this is from RANDS in Repose, the website or blog. If you're not familiar, RANDS, R-A-N-D-S, is the pen name and alter ego of Michael Lopp, a blogger, software engineering manager, and web comic author. I'd heard his name often, or I've even heard RANDS, and I never connected the two, so that actually was kind of a nice thing to discover on my own here. The piece is titled, Three Bad Managers. Subtitle, Everyone is an Adjustment. And so we have these discussions often about working in the industry and sort of navigating being an employee in an organization. And even we've had topics of being a manager and thinking about what's involved in that. And he shares these three types in this one. I'm not going to spoil the whole thing. It's a pretty good read, but he names them the artist, the dictator, and the knife. He did well under these managers. He was promoted while working for them. And maybe the crux of the whole thing is, why are they bad managers? Because in many ways, they were focused on leading and not management. I know in some circles, managing can seem like it's maybe not important. You look at all the bros, if you will, and it's all about leadership and you need to lead to inspire the people below you. But you know what? A manager should really manage and, you know, help their employees in those kinds of special ways. It doesn't delve too deep into that, but, you know, and again, leaders should lead. I don't want to spend too much time on each, but I will read a paragraph from each of the ones just to kind of get an idea what he was describing. The artist is bad because they don't value humans. It's not the part of the equation they care about, maybe introversion, but mostly because they're an artist, and what artists care about is the art, not the essential humans who build the frame, find the right paints, brushes, and make sure the artist can work in a clean, well-lit place. That's just noise. So this sort of creative type that's leading somebody beyond and not worried about helping people get through the details. So the dictator is bad because the dictatorial approach was everywhere, not just in the basement. Our one-on-one started with less than 30 seconds of pleasantries before they started their rant. It was the dictatorial rant about the most recent interesting problem, and wow, they had opinions. My initial job was to hold on for dear life. And the knife is a weird one. It requires a little bit of intro. During his one-on-one, person was very distracted and on a phone call, and then eventually got to them, and they, in the middle of this one-on-one, pulled out a knife and was playing with it during the time of the one-on-one. It wasn't threatening. He didn't feel like he was in danger, but it was just really weird. The knife is just bad. Back to the beginning, no dummies here. This is an intelligent person, and they did a good job leading a team, but they had absolutely no business attempting to manage one. Yeah, these were successful humans. It's stronger than that. I can confirm these are wildly successful leaders. I can confirm that each were very bad managers. Let's start with my belief that manager's job is to tell you where you are, and the leader's job is to tell you where you are going. Leaders are strong on strategy. Managers are strong on tactics. And so I wanted to think about this a little bit. Like, first off, maybe you could describe a little bit what you feel is that difference in balance, because I feel like you've had the management role a few times. I don't know if you would consider that you had a leadership role, but like, how would you describe the difference between those two?
So one of the challenges is the business literature tries to sometimes use, like, well, not as much recently, but originally it tended to use the words interchangeably, because it used to just be, we talked about managers,
right?
And like, you had something like a general manager who is like, would now be considered a C-level type person, right? So like, we used to just sort of use that word. And then I think it started in like the 80s that they started trying to distinguish the idea of leaders. And honestly, it was just a synonym people were using to try and make it sounded fancier.
Yes.
And then over time, it's now evolved to sort of distinguish between the two different skill sets. And leaders are meant to set goals and hopefully get the heck out of the way. Managers are often meant to be, try to help you succeed at those goals.
Yes.
The challenge with it is, even independent of those nouns, we will sometimes use the word, I've seen things like, well, team leadership. Well, for all intents and purposes, that is a tactical job. So given the way we're talking about it at the moment, that's really management rather than leadership, right?
Yeah.
So it's blurry because people use the words interchangeably. And so when you're having the conversation, you kind of have to figure out who are you talking about and what are you talking about? The other aspect of it is, I think good managers have to lead. You have to know when to put which of those hats on.
Sure.
And I think that's another reason why the lines are all very blurry. One of the things I always kind of prided myself on when I was managing, I used to joke that I was a feces umbrella, right? My goal was to let the crap that rained down from the other parts of the company not hit the folks on my team, right? Clear the road for them, let them work.
Okay.
The problem with that, so I think that's probably mostly a good managerial thing. That's not hiding them from it. It's explaining to them what's going on, but empowering them to be able to do their work.
Right.
The flip side of that is it tended to piss off the other managers, which probably meant I wasn't that great a leader, because I would get into contentious conversations with those who weren't letting my people do what their jobs were.
Right.
So, the problem is, as soon as you get outside of individual contributor, you're into politics and varying people. I personally try not to participate in them or keep them as low-key as possible. And in some environments, that works well. In some environments, that means you're roadkill.
Yeah. I think a good manager, depending on what level the organization we're looking at, is looking out for their employees, wants to make sure that they have what they need, is making sure that things are not blocked in their way. It's like a good communicator of the business goals down to them and helps to redirect them. And it's a hard skill. Something that is really not well taught. I mean, there's definitely like management schools that people send, people to look at these types of things. But there's this other sort of focus that, if you're in a small organization, that you might just have a leader and you'd end up having to sort of manage on your own. Or,
well, there are techniques you can learn, but if you don't have empathy, you have to have a desire to work and grow with people. And if you're not doing that, doesn't matter how many books you've read.
Yeah.
And it's harder. Honestly, I think it's harder in IT as well, because like traditional growth in hierarchical organizations is promotion. Well,
yeah.
A lot of programmers don't want to be promoted because they're not interested in doing management. And so now you've got to do that. Well, are they growing their skills? Are they doing new and interesting things?
Right.
Are they working on bigger projects, right? So like growth in IT is often different than your sort of traditional sales guy, whatever kind of career path, right?
Yeah. I tend to have this experience, in a mix of the jobs I've had. I've had a lot of jobs. Being a musician and trying to pursue that while still working, I'm sure actors have the same problem, is that, you've worked a lot of kind of different positions, and often they were like interested in me managing other people, moving me into that thing. They saw whatever the empathy that I had, my ability to communicate with other people, to like understand goals and set them down to everybody else and so forth. And it's a challenging thing, especially if you're not knowing, what the direction of things are, where we're headed and so forth. So they need to work in tandem with the leader in some ways. But anyway, I thought I've had a lot of jobs, and so I've been under a lot of other managers, and I thought we could kind of describe maybe some of our own names of things that we've experienced across time that have been challenges. I don't know if you want to start with some of yours, and then I have a few of my own.
Sure.
And a lot of these are tongue in cheek. yeah, but also not completely untrue.
One you and I both had a couple conversations about before is something I've heard to referred to as the seagull manager. They're the ones who swoop in, poop all over everything, and swoop back out.
Yeah.
It tends to be, often their intentions are good. They're coming in and they're managing, but they're not around long enough to see what's actually going on.
Right.
And this is usually a side effect of the organization and them being too busy to help to be able to do those things, right?
Yeah. You're left there yelling at the clouds, trying to say, hey, come back here.
Yeah. And
what do you mean by that? What are we doing?
Yeah. So I find one of the ones I worked with who was either very good or very bad at this, depending on how you look at it. It was a consulting shop, and he was better at the kind of consulting we were doing than the rest of us were. So he'd show up, we'd go, all right, here's the problems we're having with customers. Here's the two we know how to address. Here's the three we don't know how to address. And in like an hour, he'd like solve all of the world's problems. And we'd be like, yes, that makes perfect sense. And then he'd leave. And then we'd be like, wait a second, how do we do that? What did he just say? And even if you'd written it all down, like it wasn't the, like, it was just sort of like he had a bit of a, they used to talk about Steve Jobs having a reality distortion field around him, right?
And
he had a little bit of that going on that, like, while he was present, everyone was like, oh, that makes perfect sense. And then as soon as he was gone, the field dissipated and people were like, wait a second, what did he mean by that? Is that actually going to work?
Yeah.
And of course, because he was gone, we couldn't cycle back and it would be days again before we could get his attention again. Yeah, so there often tended to be a bit of a swarm of activity after he left that wasn't always productive.
Yeah, that one I've heard and have experienced of, you know, them flying in and crapping all over everything and then just flying off again. I have one that I've named the hall monitor. This was kind of a unique one that I experienced. It was a small shop. I was destined to be an educator, which is one of my backgrounds I have. And at the time, then I was also tasked with, well, we don't have a help desk person. Can you do help desk? And that'll help you learn what our organization does and all these other kinds of things. And I started helping people. And they called me in the office one day and they were really upset with me because I was moving too fast. I was running down those halls and I was helping people way too quickly. Well, why is that a problem? Well, I was setting a standard that no one else was ever going to be able to keep within that organization. That level of standard of service just won't do. It will make everyone else look bad, you know, when you're not around. So I had lots of awkward conversations with this person and other people in the workplace that I was at. And I just kept going, am I taking crazy pills? What's going on here? Wouldn't this be like a good thing that people are able to move on and do their work and not be stuck with this problem that they've had for a month or whatever? And I just came in and solved it. And I was like, this is the weirdest situation. Have you had anything like that ever?
I don't see that in IT as much, but I do remember like summer jobs and things like that, where that was an awful lot, right? It's that whole slow down, Superman, you're making the rest of us look bad, right? Yeah.
People are not allowed to fix things outside of their lane.
Yes.
Low-level service will be retained and everyone will look the same and no providing service above and beyond the standard. Do you have another one you want to share?
Yeah. The other one I see a fair amount in IT is the out-of-date coder. And this is somebody who's been promoted into management. They've been there for a while. And there's nothing wrong with that. They've got experience at the architectural level. They can often get the big picture.
Yeah.
It's when they don't know to stop that, right? Like I remember having this one manager who kept telling me stories about how he would fix it if it was in COBOL. And I'm like, but it's not. So why are we sitting here listening to old timey talk, right? Like it didn't contribute anything, right? And one of the challenges in IT, you know, one of the best managers I ever had in IT, she was non-technical. And it was because she was very, very good at actually just managing us, figuring out what the dates were, getting the right people in the room to solve problems. And because she couldn't contribute technically, she knew to stay out of the way. She'd ask questions to make sure we stayed on topic, but that was it. And I think one of the things technical people struggle with when they are promoted is finding that balancing act, right? Like, am I still contributing to the code? Am I not? If I'm not, you know, what is useful guidance versus what is just, but that's just easy. Why can't you just whatever,
right?
Which doesn't actually help anybody.
Yeah. So I had a really unique one. I call it the showman or the show person, like the greatest showman kind of thing. Like we're all part of a circus here. We are here to dazzle people and look impressive. We need to be like Google and have dedicated time for individual projects. We want to create impressive things that just showcase the ideas of technology within the organization and how we could move forward and so forth. And meanwhile, everyone would go around them to ask me to do actual work for them they knew I could do efficiently. And I like to do work for other people. It's why I do work. It has never been to make myself look incredible. Sometimes the work I do does get to shine. But if I can help everyone in the business to succeed, that's really what my goal is. You know, sometimes it happens, you know, I'm very proud of what I've created here with the podcast and other things. But in general, like my goal isn't to like create these showcase pieces that maybe I have to have like a meeting with somebody higher up and then show them this thing. And it was a really kind of an odd one. I haven't ever really experienced that kind of thing. Have you seen that in a workplace before?
So I think it may relate to the last one I have as well, which is the empire builders.
Okay.
And those are the folks who are, they're only interested in the company goals as to how it meets their ends, right? So your showman might be, I'm trying to look good to my boss because that's what gets me promoted, right? The downside of this is you end up with local optimizations, right? Like we will do something that looks really good for this department that might actually be bad for the company because we're focusing on the wrong thing.
Right.
And in particular, you'll see with this as well is, you know, people who are, their ego is connected to their headcount. So, right, well, we'll just keep growing the size of the department. And in fact, that has its own set of problems. And a reasonable institution might go, oh, this should be three departments. But no, because I'm building my empire and I'm, you know, trying to protect the empire. Or in your case, you know, we're trying to show it off so that everyone knows it's snazzy.
Yeah.
And this is a consequence, pure consequence of politics. And I think it's common in any mid to large size organization.
Yeah. I have a real quick one. I call it the complainer or the gossiper. And they just basically tell you how everything around them is effed and complain about everybody around you. And you're just like, this isn't helping me. This is like making me dislike where I am and what I'm doing because, you know, it's just a really negative environment to be in. And then you've, in the end, learned that, oh, it really wasn't all that bad anyway. And that person just really likes to gossip or really likes to complain. And then my final one, I'll just say it, the cock blocker. You just need to stay in your place and do your work. And they basically are not looking at moving you up or giving you other things that you could possibly do. They want you to stay where you are. I'll look at taking that outside book deal that we had agreed on that would be a collaboration. I'll be the one that goes to contacts and go to conventions. I don't trust you enough to meet with other people because you could possibly have a career development experience there. Why would I be interested in your career development? And then when you finally say goodbye, they're like, wow, I never realized how amazing the work that you do is on your last day of working there. It's always kind of an amazing thing. Have you had that kind of experience where somebody is like stopping you?
I've had friends go through some of that. Thankfully, it's not something I've gone through much myself. I suspect some of that is I spent most of my time in smaller organizations. And again, like, there's no chance for a promotion in a startup. How promotion happens is you grow.
Right.
So there tends to be less of the completely different set of problems, don't get me wrong, but you have less of the backbiting-y type, I have to look good, you have to look bad kind of stuff, because that tends to be tied to the how do I succeed, which is tied to, you know, promotion of things in large organizations. So
yeah, I mean, so much promotion today is just, I'm going to go take, you know, go somewhere else. And, you know, you hop across the road. Like in Hawaii, there were like four different banks and all of them were across the street from each other in downtown Honolulu. And I would just see people just, you know, literally walk across the street and get a job there and so forth. And this was not just, you know, in you know, programming or IT. It was like all the different areas of the bank, which was just weird, you know, but I guess that's a thing. I've almost always left because of bad managers. I mean, just kind of across the board. And I think that's a pretty high percentage of people that are out there.
Yes.
So it's interesting to think about it.
Yeah. I've heard a cliche, which is people don't leave bad jobs, they leave bad managers. Yeah.
Anyway, it's fun to explore this stuff and kind of come up with our own names. You know, some of this is tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, some of it's just like, I guess I wish we could come back and have another conversation about, like, well, what's the advice of dealing with these situations outside of leaving, you know?
Learning to manage up is a skill in its own sense. And whether you're at the bottom of the pile or anywhere except the top of the pile, I think that's a very, very useful life skill.
Yeah.
And like with managing down, you have to adjust your style a little bit based on the personalities that are in the room. And in fact, he gets into this a little bit in the article, right? Like a little bit of that. Okay, so in this situation, this is how I dealt with this guy. And a couple of them were successful and one of them just wasn't for him, right? So so there is advice out there on how to try and tackle these kinds of problems.
Yeah. Well, all right, let's dig into projects here.
I would just like to say that I'm, without checking transcripts, I'm pretty sure that's the most scatological references we've made in one podcast.
Yeah. It's probably a content warning for the first time, right? and other things. So, sorry. All right. So, I have a project. It's from Filippo Mameli. And I really like this project as more of an exploration that you could do to look at sort of modern tooling in creating projects. It uses a bunch of these sort of modern tools to create, as the names of the projects say, a Python data project template. And again, kind of more geared toward data projects, but I feel like even, you know, other types of projects you might create inside of Python, you might be interested in templates. And I want to showcase it because it could introduce you to some of these new tools and think about the concept of templating and what modern tools could go into that. He uses a tool that I was not familiar with called Copier. It's a templating or bootstrapping thing. So he considers this a copier template for bootstrapping modern Python data projects with a reproducible production-ready workflow. Then he lists a bunch of the tools, UV, Rough, Tie, which is a type-checking tool that we haven't discussed too much on the show, but again, very popular new tool. Also from Astral. All three of those other ones are Astral ones. Tests, docs, and releases, and then optional Docker information, and then he includes a Marimo playground. Again, I'm a big fan of Marimo. I know across last year or so, I've focused on that a bunch, but it is a nice tool, again, for exploring and trying things out, especially for data stuff. I don't want to go too deep into the details because I feel like it's just a laundry list of things, but the links are there. It's very, very opinionated as far as building a template. The Copier tool is kind of similar to Cookie Cutter, if you aren't familiar with that, especially tools like Flask or Django or those types of projects. A lot of people like Cookie Cutter as a way of kind of getting things started, hence the name. Copier is in that same vein, and then it has some explorations. I'll include a link to it if you haven't checked out. We mentioned UV for dependency management, Rough for linting and formatting, Tie for type checking, pre-commit, which is something great for having hooks for, you know, running before your commits, PyTest and PyTest coverage, Marimo we mentioned. He steers toward Polars in this case, DuckDB for the database, because it has these nice in-process and analytical SQL queries. Check out some previous shows as we discussed this stuff before. Seaborn for quick visualizations, MKDocs for the documentation, Docker for containerized builds, and then Commitizen for conventional commits. So again, if you haven't heard any of these things, he has links to that whole technology stack. The README is just this laundry list of what's kind of happening. And then he has a quick start of getting involved in using this project. So if you're interested in templates or maybe creating templates for your own stuff, maybe especially for data projects, something kind of cool to check out. What do you got?
I've got a quick project this week from friend of the show, Michael Kennedy. He has been busy building stuff lately, and one of those things is a tool called Tallyman. I'm sure I'm not alone in occasionally running word count on a coding project just to feel like I've been doing something. Look at all those lines of code. I must have been productive.
Big gold star for me.
Exactly. Only looking at a raw line of code count, though, is more or less about my ego rather than providing actual useful information. So Tallyman evolves this idea a little bit. It changes it into something a little more useful. When you run it on your code, it gives you line counts grouped by file type. So instead of just getting 10,000 lines of code, you get 8,000 Python, 1,500 HTML, and 500 Markdown. Within each of those types, you get even more information, separating lines that do things, like code or words, from blank and comment lines. So all of that would be useful enough. But to cap it off, it also summarizes the output, grouping things like code, spec, design, and data together, giving you output on all the different parts of your project. So if you want to know a bit more about what you're working on, or if you're diving into a new project and want to have a quick idea of how it breaks down, Tallyman can give you a good overview.
Yeah, it's like a much more detailed version of the GitHub little sidebar there that tells you what languages are used in it. Yeah, pretty cool. Awesome. Well, thanks, Chris, for coming back on the show this week and sharing all these PyCoders goodies with us.
Cheers.
All right. Thanks again to Agent Field for supporting the show. If today's conversation got you thinking about what comes after prompt chains, Agent Field is worth exploring. Production-ready examples you can clone, deploy, or adapt today. Autonomous engineering team, security auditor, code reviewer, each orchestrating hundreds of agents in a single workflow on any model. Search Agent Field on GitHub or visit agentfield.ai. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.